And welcome to the alternative media. I'm your host, Patrick Slattery. We have a great show planned for you today. This should be exciting. First, we are going to have an interview I conducted earlier this week with Professor James Petras of New York State University at Binghamton. He is one of the leading, I won't say the leading, because I think Kevin McDonald is really the leading scholar on issues of Judaism, Zionism. But James Petras is right up there. He's somebody, he didn't make his mark in that field. He made his mark more in Central Latin American studies. But a very interesting interview with him. And just before we get that rolling, okay, well, it is ready. Let's go for that right away. Let's hear that interview. Director, can you please play the clip?
Hello, Professor Petras.
Yes.
Hi, this is Patrick Slattery.
Oh, yes, let's talk.
Okay, great, thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. I've been a long time fan. Okay, well, first of all, so you are a professor emeritus at the State University of New York at Binghamton?
Yes.
Okay. And you've talked a lot and written a lot about a Zionist power configuration. How do you define the Zionist power configuration? Where does it operate geographically and institutionally? And what are its power resources?
Well, let's start one at a time. The Zionist power configuration is an organized unit that goes far beyond simply a lobby, in the sense that a lobby would be a group organized in Washington that would be pressuring on existing power organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Rifle Club or whatever. Now, the Zionists are different in several senses. One, they are actually in government. That is, there's a whole range of officials from Treasury Department to Pentagon, military,
mm-hmm.
and the State Department, the advisory organizations that especially deal with the Middle East, and similar structures. They also have media influence in the principal media, in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, among others.
Mm-hmm.
They also have direct influence in terms of financing politicians through multi-million dollar and billion dollar organizations that have a direct tie to U.S. policy and support for Israel. So that's a sample of what I mean by the Zionist power configuration. That is to say, it goes beyond simply a pressure group organizing on congressional voters, congress people. So that's the first question. What was the second question?
Where does it operate geographically and institutionally, and what are its power resources?
Well, its principal focus is in Washington on the Congress. Its second focus is nationwide in particular regions like New York, California, but it goes across the country. They have organizations, particularly if you look at the members of the 51 or 52 principal American Jewish organizations.
Mm-hmm.
They have a spread across the nation in practically every state in the Union and probably in most major cities, where they have the Jewish organizations that are affiliated with the principal organizations. So they have enormous leverage far beyond merely saying New York and Washington and mm-hmm. Los Angeles. And they are able to use networks to stigmatize and slander and fire and exclude educated people and others who criticize the Israeli policy.
Mm-hmm. And
they're a single-issue organization. Whatever is good for Israel, whatever ruler is in Israel, is supported. They're totally uncritical. They don't debate issues. They transmit issues.
Okay, and now you mentioned earlier the proliferation of Zionists in the Treasury Department, the State Department, Defense Department, and elsewhere. If there was a threat to Zionist positions and privileges in government institutions or academic institutions, would this also be something that Zionism would oppose? Is it strictly single issue, what's good for Israel?
No. Anybody that criticizes Israel, whether they're in government or out of government, whether they're in academia or not in academia,
mm-hmm.
the organizational structure would go into play. As you see at the universities, the movement for boycott, divestment, and investment, they have been constantly attacked by Zionist structures, naming people, getting people fired, blacklisting people, stigmatizing them in faculties, what have you. They have a blacklist they run and they promote. Doctors have also been criticized. Lawyers have been criticized and scandalized, not just criticized, but scapegoated and slandered.
Okay. I saw your recent article on, I guess it was something about meritocracy in the American government. I forgot the title of it, but it was on Ron Unce's site. I don't know if that was just something Ron Unce picked up.
Ron Unce publishes practically all my stuff.
Okay. And are you familiar with his article from a few years ago, the Myth of American Meritocracy, and he looks at Ivy League admissions?
I saw it. I don't recall it in great detail, but he was very critical of the way in which they manipulated entrance and so forth, but I'm not up to date on it.
Okay, yeah. One of his findings was that even after correcting for things like PSAT scores or other academic achievements, other measures of academic achievements, Jewish applicants were much more likely to be admitted to the Ivy League schools, the elite schools, compared to non-Jewish whites. And it was something like a 14-to-1 ratio. It was astounding, but you know, you have a situation in Harvard, for instance, where you have about 25% Jewish student body, according to Hillel. And when you do the math, you look at the provost data on other racial groups, there's only room for about 20 or 25% non-Jewish whites after you subtract out the others.
That fits in with what we've seen in the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
where you go 40% Jews, 0% Protestants.
Right. So
there's clearly a political influence here, political power, money, organization, etc.
So for the Zionist power configuration, is it simply to protect Israeli interests, or is it also to protect the interests of the Jews in the diaspora as well?
Well, I think it's the overlap here with, I think, a lot of influence that overlaps between well-to-do and influential Jews who are also happen to be supporters of Israel, and I think they reinforce each other.
I see.
There is also a great many Jews that don't go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, probably a great majority, you say 25%, but probably about 75% of Jews don't go to the Ivy League schools.
Right. Now, your recent article, of course, was pointing out the prevalence in our State Department and other places of Jewish individuals who had come out of the Ivy League schools.
Particularly individuals who deal with the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
there's where you have an extraordinary imbalance, if you will. Anybody that's called an Arabist or who has a balanced position is usually shunted out or created pressure on them or insults and marginalized. So you saw this very clearly with the Bush and, well, it goes back to Clinton, Bush, and Obama. There's a great overrepresentation. And then if you look at the economic dimensions, too, you find that all the people in the
Federal Reserve,
you'll find that it runs back quite a few years. And this is, you even get officials from the Israeli Federal Reserve that come from the U.S. and go back to the U.S.
Oh, yes.
So there's virtually no differentiation.
So the current Fisher, Stanley Fisher, was the head of the Bank of Israel, and now he's the vice chair of the Fed.
Right. Now he's pulling the strings for the U.S. federal policy.
So,
Yellen.
Yes.
Yellen and Fisher.
That's right. How would you define Zionism? So your conception of Zionism...
Zionism is the belief that Israel has supreme allegiance and that Israel has a sacred policy because of its descendants from the people of God. So it has a religious dimension, it has a ethnic, political sovereignty that dictates policy above and beyond anybody's national embodiment.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter if you were born in the U.S., if you become a Zionist, you're first and foremost an Israeli.
I see.
Israeli Jew.
I see.
Because there are Israeli Arabs.
Right. Now, moving to the State Department, I was actually visiting the State Department about a year ago, and I did pop into Victoria Nuland's office, the Assistant Secretary of State.
Kagan's wife.
And
Nuland is a long-time Zionist and goes back time. That's not a real name. She's
Nudelman.
Her father's name was Nudelman. Yeah, that's right. And she has been 100%. And she has been not only involved on Israeli issues, but been involved in...
Russia and Ukraine.
No, Ukraine.
Right. And Professor Stephen F. Cohen, who writes a great deal about Russia, has talked about her and other officials as having kind of a vendetta or even a jihad against Putin. And if you think of the events that unfolded in the 1990s in Russia, where you had a privatization with a great deal of input from our Treasury Department, from people like Lawrence Summers, as you know, that resulted in a takeover of the Russian economy by largely Jewish oligarchs, why is it that you would have our State Department, and is this kind of, why would you have this Jewish or Zionist agenda against Putin? How does that fit within your...
I don't think it was against Putin. I think it was against the Russian people.
Against the Russian people.
Insofar as they stripped the economy, privatized, and concentrated, as you said, 8 of the 9 top oligarchs were of Jewish background and became citizens of Israel, by the way, among other things. Now, that's an interesting question that you raise about the connection between U.S. State Department officials and the rise and concentration of wealth among Jewish oligarchs. I have not really studied that in detail. But it's an interesting hypothesis to examine the implications and raise some interesting hypothesis about why and how that came about.
Yes. Well, you did have Lawrence Summers, who was at the Treasury Department. You had Peter Orszag, who was a young man at the time, but you might be familiar with him. He wound up being the...
Yes, I know who he is.
Yes. And then Jeffrey Sachs and other people from Harvard were among them. I'd like to ask you about, well, you were a professor of Norman Finkelstein. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
yeah, one semester, I think.
One semester. And I saw a debate between the two of you, and you were debating basically, I guess, whether the...
The power of Israel and its role in making U.S. policy. And he was following, to some degree, Chomsky, who's a total snow job on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not quite as bad. Chomsky's the worst on the power of Zionism. Though he criticizes Israel and he uses virulent and vituperous language on Israel's role, he's opposed to BDS, for example. And he never has taken up the issue. He's ignored all the facts about the issue, about who votes for who and why, who funds the voters for Israel, etc. He totally ignores all the factual documentation. But Norman takes it up and says it's one factor. Where I, on Middle East policy, I say it's the dominant factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I'll say this, that Norman paid a price for that because they went for him, including his nemesis at Harvard, Dershowitz.
Alan Dershowitz, yes.
So, in a way, he paid a price for ignoring the central role that Zionists play in undercutting criticism of Israel.
So, that leads me to the question, what motivates somebody like Noam Chomsky or perhaps Norman Finkelstein to contend that Israel is an instrument
Norman,
of American imperialism?
I think you have to separate.
Well, then I think
Norman has, to some degree, attacked the Zionists and Dershowitz and others. So, I mean, compared to most non-Jewish writers and academics as a whole, his position is much better. Chomsky is another fish.
Okay.
Chomsky has deliberately avoided this issue, and one can speculate why. Is it his earlier ties with the kibbutz, with Israel? Is it some underlying commitments that he has? Is it a way of protecting himself from getting even more rabid attacks from the pro-Israel crowd? You can guess on what's involved, but it's clearly one of his major deficiencies.
Well, though
he's made other errors, his analysis of Latin America has been off the mark several times.
Well, those were my questions. We're left to speculate what his actual motives are, whether he's trying to protect his own position, whether he's actually trying to protect Zionism in a way by distracting attention from the Zionist power configuration.
It is now, we're coming up on the break. We will be listening to more from Professor James Petras later in the broadcast, and I'll be taking calls at 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443. Okay, we are back. This is the Alternative Media with your host, Patrick Slattery. We were listening to an interview with James Petras that I conducted earlier in the week, and we will be getting back
to this.
Oh, we're not. We'll be getting back to that after the next break. But for this segment, one thing I want to announce to you all is that John Stadtmiller has asked for your assistance in one final push to pay down our bills before we bring on a new crew to help generate revenue internally. We never want to launch another pledge drive, and we need a little help from our listeners this weekend, so we'll have a strong start with our hosts, our new hosts and partners. So you can call 1-800-724-2719, extension 1 or extension 3. That would be 1-800-724-2719. 19, extension 1, or extension 3. And as I mentioned, I will be taking callers later. The listener call-in line is 1-800-313-9443. But, you know, this issue of the fundraiser, this is important. We don't have all of the economic resources that the Zio Media has. I mean, the Zio Media, these are multi-billion dollar conglomerates, and they have a lot of reach. They have a lot of brainwashing capacity. But we do have our own media, and RBN is a really central part of it. It's a great way for people to get an alternative media, to get alternative views, to get the truth. And we're not afraid of the truth. So I want everybody to, if you're able to call in, one more time, it's 1-800-724-2719. So we'll be doing that. This issue of having our own media is so vital, because what separates us from our liberation? We'll be talking about this with our guests later in the next hour, but this issue of not having our own media, or now we're creating our own media, we have to support it. What we can do with just the meager resources we have is just phenomenal. Look at what's going on this year. We have a golden opportunity in the Trump campaign, and he does have billions of dollars. But of course, and he provides a great opportunity for us. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things he's not going to say. He's not going to talk about even the issues that James Petras was talking about with the Israeli penetration into our government, into our universities, into our media. He won't talk about that. He'll even mouth these tired old lines about Israel being, you know, a great friend and a great ally. I hope he doesn't mean it. I'm not going to automatically assume he's playing some sort of deep game, but he says enough things that are important that I know it's worth supporting him. But what we're able to do, I mean, you wouldn't have the success that Donald Trump's having. He couldn't have the success he's having if it wasn't outlets like RBN and others. You know, I'm the co-host of Dr. David Duke's radio show. You have other media outlets and other websites that are doing a great job and really having a great deal of penetration. You know, on David Duke's show, when he says things, sometimes we'll even hear the president talking about it. And so these alternative media forms are so important, and in laying the groundwork. And, you know, you are hearing us through RBN. It's really important to support RBN. And this year is so critical. This is going to be a transformative year where the Trump campaign provides us with an opportunity. But vehicles like RBN are, you know, what really is going to be the avenue for getting the truth through. Because what separates us from our liberation is simply getting the truth out. Okay, we will be back with more of that interview after this next break. This is The Alternative Media with your host, Patrick Slattery. Never let it show, so she could never answer yes or no. He always. Are back. This is The Alternative Media with your host, Patrick Slattery. So In just a moment, we're going to be playing the second part of the interview with Professor James Petras. I just want to remind you, we will be taking calls. The listener call-in line is 1-800-313-9443. And without further ado, Mr. Engineer, are you ready to roll the second part of the interview? Okay. We're just queuing it up. That bumper music, by the way, that was Just a Gigolo. That's a nice old song. That was requested by our guest from a couple of weeks ago, Benjamin Fulford. That's going to be his theme music next time he's on the show. He knows all about that. Actually, I think he should do the vocals for it. And now let's listen to part two of my interview with Professor James Petras.
Well, how about this? How important is Zionism to our politics? Is it just one of many competing forces?
No, it's the most important policy on the major area where we've had the most important wars in the last 25 years.
So you cannot understand American
politics.
We
have had wars where? In the Middle East against Muslim countries, Iraq in particular, Afghanistan secondary, Lebanon, and in every one of those instances, the Zionists played major role in making the U.S. the principal actor. Israel doesn't have an impact on China policy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Israel doesn't have an influence on U.S. Latin American policy. It doesn't have an effect on Asia policy. But it does have a major influence, the major influence in the Middle East. In particular, overwhelming influence in the Iraq War.
Do you think it has an influence in our relations with Russia? Right now we are dangerously close to war with Russia.
Yes, but Israel also has relations with Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure of the details of it. But they have met and have discussed and shared policies. I don't think they agree on major issues. But they don't lead to any Russian denunciation of Israel on any major scale or scope.
Mm-hmm. Here's another question. Why are so few people in academia willing to speak out about Zionist power, especially in the social sciences, which are in the midst of it, and you know, people in the social sciences are trained to understand the structure of society and its power relations, yet almost all of them keep their mouths shut. Are there any academics
who
can...
Let's say, first of all, we got to screen out people that are ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, people who are apolitical, that don't want to speak out on anything. They've got their heads buried in their little projects. Then of those people who are at any way involved, there's fear. Why become involved? There are others that are associated with prominent Zionists in the government. So some of it is political association.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is intimidation and fear. And another is opportunism, wanting to get ahead. I'll let you know that I get all my stuff published on Latin America, major publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came up with the first book on Israel, all my publishers turned me down.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, this is too controversial. Some of our readers are book users in our classroom. Classroom book will not like to read books put out by someone who's very critical of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
There's intimidation, there's blackmail, there's ostracism among those people who are knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm. And have you suffered any adverse consequences from your outspokenness?
Oh, sure, including death threats.
Including death threats. I see.
Yeah. Insults. Including by left critics.
Mm-hmm.
The left critics are awful talking about Zionists. They have refused, and I'm talking about the small magazines.
Mm-hmm.
New Left Review, for example, has not published any serious study. They may have recently published something about a year ago or something, but none of the major left-wing journals. I think a lot of them are cowards.
Are you familiar with Gilad Atzmon, who regarding...
Yes, I wrote a press blurb for him on his first book.
The Wandering Who.
And his
conception of anti-Zionist Zionists?
Yeah, I'm a bit bothered by that. I think he's... There's something there, but I think he exaggerates it.
Mm-hmm. I see. I interviewed recently Professor Kevin MacDonald, the psychology professor from...
Yes, I know who he is.
And are you familiar with his work?
I've read a couple of his essays, yes.
And do you feel that he's onto something?
Well, he covers a lot of ground. I'd say he makes some interesting points, social, psychological points. Others, I don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't keep a file on him.
No. Okay.
All right. Have a good
afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Bye.
And I'll send you the transcript. Bye.
Okay, we are back. That was the interview I conducted earlier this week with Professor James Petras. And joining me now to help digest the interview, we have attorney Don Advo from behind the lines of Mexican-occupied Southern California. Is it just Southern California, Don?
Oh, I think, well, given the attacks on the Trump campaign up in Northern California, I think the whole state's pretty much been taken over by them.
Is Costa Mesa Northern California?
No, Costa Mesa is Southern California. It's Orange County. It's okay. Way south of here. The problem is they're... he was in Burlingame, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. He went to the Republican convention yesterday, which was the day after the attacks. Excuse me, the day after the attacks in Orange County, and they almost shut down the Republican convention up there. I mean, it's almost like a third world republic now. It's as though democracy and free elections mean nothing. If these Mexican mobs decide they want to shut down the campaign of a major candidate, they can do it. And now it's reaching, I don't know whether to feel good about it in the sense that it's finally reached a level that it can no longer be denied or concealed, or to see that it's grown so much more powerful than it was. I mean, I've watched this stuff go down since the 1980s when they launched an attack on a group of American nationalists in the city of Anaheim in the early 1980s. They were having a peaceful demonstration, and they were attacked by these Mexican punks. The cops drove by and did nothing, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I saw a bit of CNN's coverage of it, and it was interesting to see Wolf Blitzer, our friend Wolf Blitzer, formerly of the Jerusalem Post and of AIPAC, now CNN's number one newscaster. Interesting to see him defend the protesters as being Americans, exercising their American rights of free speech when talking to the a Trump campaign spokeswoman who had pointed out that they had Mexican flags, not American flags. Don, I
didn't hear that. That really sickens me. That makes me want to puke.
Thanks. Well, I hope you have your bucket nearby. I always keep mine nearby every time I'm watching CNN. Now, regarding Professor Petras's interview, you might have missed a bit of it, but towards the end, he was, it was amazing because he's somebody who actually is from the left, but he's saying... everything he said just about is the same type of thing that we would say, or that Kevin MacDonald would say, or even David Duke would say. He doesn't go quite as far on everything. And one example of him not going quite as far is he said that Zionists, they completely control that most important, that most critical part of our policy, which is, you know, our foreign policy in the Middle East. But he says they don't have, Israel doesn't have an impact on China policy. It doesn't have an impact on Asia policy. And I'd say, actually, I think it does. I think it does, both directly and indirectly. I see regarding China, a lot of, Jewish professors like Noah Feldman, for instance, who wrote a book. He was one of these professors that, that Elena Kagan had hired to Harvard Law School when she was there, waving her tribal banner and claiming Harvard Law School as a province of Israel. But he wrote a book called The New Cool War, basically calling for a Cold War with China, and they are pushing. Bad relations. They have a great deal of influence in Japan, as Benjamin Fulford was talking about a couple of weeks ago when he was on the show. And they're trying to push China and Japan apart. And this is really kind of the divide and conquer scenario that David Duke talks about a lot. Did you have any impressions about some of the things Professor Petras had to say, and whether it was maybe him not being, some areas where he came up short, or some areas where you're impressed that somebody who has spent his whole life as a leftist in academia, how impressive it is that he would say the things he did say?
Well, one thing that impresses me, that gives me courage, that gives me optimism, is that notwithstanding he comes from the left, from a completely opposite political perspective, he analyzed a social situation. He analyzed the exercise of political power in our government and came up with much the same conclusions that we come up with. Mm-hmm. It's as though, the physical sciences, you don't have left-wing or right-wing physics or chemistry or algebra. Generally, everybody with the same political registration gets the same answers. And now, I have said when talking about Jewish power that I don't so much distinguish between Zionist power and Jewish power. I don't think there's really that much difference. But I have said this, that Jewish power is to politics and economic power what gravity is to the physical sciences. It is the basic ordering principle. And I think that he didn't use those words, but the gist of what he says is that they really are the dominant power that controls politics in this country. I was very impressed, very alarmed at his talk about the hammerlock they have in the State Department, and his familiarity with people like Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky. Those were interesting comments that he made, and they're perfectly consistent with everything that I have ever been taught to know about those people. Chomsky is particularly vicious.
Yeah, he distinguished between them because, Finkelstein has his shortcomings. At the same time, he does some very valuable work. Chomsky, on the other hand, he called him the biggest snow job out there. Those were his words. Which is very interesting. And I really like your analogy of gravity to Zionist power. Zionist power or Jewish power is to politics what gravity is to physics. It's really the central organizing principle. And even though Professor Petras is somebody who has been from the left his entire career, did you hear how critical he was of what he called leftist media outlets, and how they're just not, how they're complicit in repressing this truth about Zionist gravity in American politics and world politics? Very interesting.
I was very heartened by it, and I was very gratified that his analysis, even though he uses different words than I use, essentially the same as my own. They really have a hammerlock. They really have a stranglehold on the arteries, on the circulatory system of power in this country.
And, you mentioned different vocabulary, and that's I think, something that's really important, something that where we can make a lot of progress, because there is a different vocabulary that's used by people. There's a lot of people like Professor Petras who have similar views, but they express it in different words. And then if you go to more of a mass level, you know, I think there's a lot of people, not necessarily a majority of people, but there's a very significant number of people who voted for Bernie Sanders this past election season, the primary season, who will vote for Donald Trump in the general election. There's a similar appeal, and I think to a large extent, some of the reasons they voted for Bernie Sanders were areas where he's kind of a snow job, and where Donald Trump's more of the real thing. You know, certainly in terms of a rational foreign policy that's not tied to Israeli interests, or, you know, not even Israeli interests so much as just Jewish fanatic interests. A lot of people assume that Bernie Sanders has, you know, a rational, peaceful foreign policy, when he really didn't. And, you know, even in his anti-banking rhetoric, we know that Ron Paul was very bitter about the role he played in watering down Ron Paul's and the Fed bill, or even audit the Fed bill. He was very critical of him there.
Oh, Sanders? Sanders attacked Ron Paul's bill?
No, Ron Paul, well, yes, because Sanders was the co-sponsor of it in the Senate, but he watered it down.
Oh, okay.
And Ron Paul was very bitter about that in 2010. You know, he gave interviews being very critical of Bernie Sanders for that reason. So I think a lot of the appeal of Bernie Sanders, which isn't necessarily always genuine, some of it might be genuine, but some of it is more of a snow job. I think a lot of those people will be voting for Donald Trump, and if we are able to translate into their language even more, I mean that's really the key to getting them is by you know, if you're going to reach them, you have to reach them with language they understand.
Well, I think you're absolutely right in that regard. I don't think there's much authenticity about Sanders personally. I don't trust him at all. I think he does hate bankers. I think he does hate millionaires and billionaires, primarily because he would like to be one, and he's never been able to achieve that.
Okay, I'm hearing our bumper music coming up, but we will be back after the break with more of the alternative media. Anybody can name that bumper music, you will get a brass figgily with oak leaf clusters. That was the award that Gene Shepherd would promise to his own listeners on his radio show 50 years ago. So, and I was one of those listeners. You know, in this next hour, I are you going to be able to stay on during the next hour? Because we have this great guest who I'm sure you're familiar with, Andrew Anglin, who runs the website, The Daily Stormer. Will you be able to stay on with us?
Oh, sure. I'd be honored to. I know I've never been on with Andrew, but I've heard him on David Duke. I've heard him and followed him. And I go to his website every day. It's one of my favorites. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be honored, be tickled to death to be on with Andrew Anglin.
Okay, yeah, he'll be joining us just at the top of the hour. And I do want to, you know, one more time, regarding this fundraiser for RBN, you know, when you're at work or play, listen live to RBN anytime from your phone, and that would be at the phone number where you can listen live is 605-562-5111. That's 605-562-5111 for real news, real talk, real people, because you can handle the truth. And remember, for the donations, that number would be 1-800-724-2719, extension 1 or extension 3. So, Don, when was the first time you saw Andrew Anglin's site, The Daily Stormer, and what was your first impression of it?
Well, it used to be called Total Fascism, I think, was the name of it. Yeah, really, really subtle. Not quite so blunt as another website that was put out there by a guy named Mike Delaney. That website was called Rat Faced Jews.
I mean, this is over the top. This is trolling, and this is something that, you know, I'm born in 1957. A lot of this stuff I don't understand. It goes over my head, and I want to be asking Andrew about it because I've heard him talk. He was on David Duke's show the past couple of days. He's very intelligent, very well spoken. Total Fascism.
That was the original name, and it was very direct and very hard hitting. And I like that. I like it. I think we have been so conditioned not to criticize Jews. We have been so conditioned to walk on eggshells and I've heard Jews speak at conferences and there's talk about Jewish power and somebody said, well, Jews have a lot of power and they influence the government. And the guy says, oh, you have to be very careful about that. You have to be very careful. I'm thinking, why? I mean, why do you get more legal protection than I get? And of course, the answer is they get more legal protection because they have more power. They are the real rulers of this country. And we've said it before, and no doubt we need to say it again.
The music's starting. We will be back at the top of the hour, and you will not want to miss this. Andrew Anklin, Don, and myself, Patrick Slack.
He's the Sheik of Araby, as you can plainly see. At night when he's asleep, into his tent he'll creep. And the stars that shine above will light their way to love. He rules this land with sheep, the Sheik of Araby.